The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on January 8, 1984 in New Orleans, Louisiana. The class begins with a reading from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, verse 40.
But if one does not attain such a perfectional stage, then he loses both materially and spiritually. It is enjoined in the scriptures that one has to suffer the reaction of not executing prescribed duties. Therefore, one who fails to discharge transcendental activities properly becomes subjected to these reactions. The Bhagavatam assures the unsuccessful transcendentalist that there need be no worries. Even though he may be subjected to the reaction of not perfectly executing prescribed duties, he is still not a loser because auspicious Krishna consciousness is never forgotten. And one so engaged will continue to be so even if he is low-born in the next life. On the other hand, one who simply follows strictly the prescribed duties need not necessarily attain auspicious results if he is lacking in Krishna consciousness. Before I go on, just to give a little background, this is Sankhya Yoga chapter. Krishna described to Arjuna the process of mystic meditation. Arjuna said he wanted to find out what was the truth, wanted to realize the self. Actually, we are a combination of material body, a mind, and the self. We are actually the self, and the mind and the material body are gross and subtle and gross body, respectively. For caring about the soul or the self within this material world, self-realization means to realize the self. Normally, we are aware of the body. Some people are aware of their psyche, or their astral body, or the mind. But to realize the self, that is considered to be self-realization. The self is the active principle in the body. So Krishna described various systems of yoga. Yoga means to link up with the Supreme. By the process of yoga, by linking up with the Supreme, one can realize the Supreme, Absolute Truth, as well as the self. So this chapter, Krishna had previously described the process of Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya Yoga means to sit in meditation in a secluded place, on a kusha grass, in a forest or on the Himalayas, and to meditate on the form in the heart of the Supreme Lord. And there to just not eat too much, not eat too little, not sleep too much, not sleep too little, sit straight up, looking at the tip of the nose, controlling the breathing and performing the Eightfold Mystic Yoga System. So Arjuna replied that this seems impossible for me. This seems to be more difficult than to control the mind, to have the mind be peaceful in that situation for me, which seems to be easier to control a hurricane. I couldn't imagine just sitting in one place day after day, week after week, month after month until I achieve self-realization. I'd never be able to just sit still. Then Krishna said, well, by practice, you can control the mind. And then Arjuna's reply was, if somebody engages rather in devotional service, which is another process of yoga called bhakti yoga, or any form of yoga, and halfway through or partway through fails to finish it, then you lost time in your material pursuits, and you didn't finish your spiritual pursuits, so at that time, you lost out in both the worlds. This is my fear. So then Krishna replied that there's nothing to fear. Because even if, it's very clearly said in this verse today that a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction, either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. Whatever amount of progress one has made spiritually, that remains as an asset. When the body becomes uninhabitable, the soul or the self continues to exist. It goes on to a new body. So even at the time of taking another birth and reincarnation or transmigration of the soul, at that time one is still cognizant of, or that one's spiritual assets are still there. There are many histories to this. In our booklet, Coming Back, there's a description of Maharaj King Bharat and how he recalled his previous life. So, however, if one even works very hard in his material life, but at the end of life he has to lose whatever materially he's been able to accumulate, he can't take anything with him. Spiritually, whatever you accumulate, it's your asset. You don't lose it. But materially, whatever you accumulate, you can't take anything with you. And if you're unable to accumulate, if you're unable to achieve your material goal, tough luck. Then you don't get anything spiritual, neither did you get anything material. And even if you get something material, that's for one lifetime, and then you're back where you started again in the next lifetime, maybe in a very bad situation. So analyzing both the sides, advice is given that one shouldn't worry about performing some type of spiritual activities, even if it may potentially make a difference in how much a person would materially progress. That is actually also not supported. That a person's material success would not be affected by practicing spiritual life in terms of the amount of happiness achieved. The exact form may vary, but the happiness or the misery that a person is going to get, that comes automatically according to the law of karma or reaction and effect. So just let me finish this purport here. Prabhupada goes on to say, the purport may be understood as follows. Humanity may be divided into two sections, namely the regulated and the non-regulated. Those who are engaged simply in bestial sense gratifications without knowledge of their next life or spiritual salvation belong to the non-regulated section. And those who follow the principles of prescribed duties in the scriptures are classified amongst the regulated section. The non-regulated section, both civilized and non-civilized, educated and non-educated, strong and weak, are full of animal propensities. Their activities are never auspicious because enjoying the animal propensities of eating, sleeping, defending and mating, they perpetually remain in material existence, which is always miserable. On the other hand, those who are regulated by scriptural injunctions and thus gradually rise to Krishna consciousness, certainly progress in life. Prabhupada goes on to say that if you take the path of auspiciousness, you could divide that into a further three sections. One is the followers of scriptural rules and regulations who are enjoying material prosperity. Two, those who are trying to find out the ultimate liberation from material existence. And three, those who are devotees in Krishna consciousness. And then basically, in the Vedic culture, society was divided according to the amount of spiritual interest, spiritual advancement a person had. The basic goal of the Varnashram system is to bring people up The Varnashram system is the ancient system of Vedic culture. Now there's a perverted reflection of that still existing in India. The Varnashram system is a scientific system of assigning certain occupational duties to different types of persons. A priest, a brahmana, a teacher would have a certain type of responsibilities to society. Administrator, warrior, general, king has a different set of responsibilities. A businessman, a different set. And a service holder, yet another group of responsibilities. The intellectual class is meant to lead a very simple life, meant to teach and advise others to eat a very simple, pure diet, has much responsibility, but is also given respect and is supported by society. The administrative class is supposed to protect the citizens from illegal activities, from criminals, from invasions, and so on. They're supposed to regulate the activities or do some sort of administration. They have a different set of rules. They're supposed to take the advice from the spiritual persons. The business community, they're supposed to provide the economic base for the whole nation, the whole world. They have another set of rules. And this way, everyone has got a particular responsibility to society, but the goal of the different occupational duties and of the spiritual stages was to gradually bring one up to the point of God-realization, self-realization. The example is just like, for instance, in the Ramayana, written by Valmiki Muni, King Dasarath was visited by, I believe it was Vasishtha Muni. And when Vasishtha came to his court, he asked him that, how is your progress in conquering reincarnation? How is the progress in your battle to conquer reincarnation, to overcome? Basically, the great sages, the great munis, they were not concerned so much with the material side. They were more interested in achieving liberation and achieving a relationship with the Supreme and ending the material bondage. Because of their auspicious activities, they would benefit the entire humanity. Most of the pious people in the world, they perform any kind of a religious activity to get a blessing from God so that they can have material prosperity. Like in Germany, after the war, when they thought that God had forsaken them, so many people became atheists because they had prayed during the war that our husbands will come back, that we'll win, God bless us. Of course, they're praying on both sides. So Krishna's in a tough situation. Whose side is? So he had to more or less, in such situations, he has to leave it up to the individuals. Karma. So when they lost, of course they were the aggressors, when they lost and they thought, well, God forsake our prayers. See, because most people, they only see God as some type of order supplier, Sears catalog or something, that you can just order anything you want and he'll bring it. So when he doesn't give it, then they lose faith. They don't actually understand the higher relationship or spiritual transcendental understanding about the Self and the Supreme Self, how the material world is situated, they're concerned on a very simple level. Just like in Russia, after the war, after one of the wars, anyway, the communists, they're trying to convince the people that they should give up religion. So the people are going to church. So then the communists would say, oh, go all go into church and you pray for bread. You're hungry, go and pray for bread. So they went to the church and they prayed, God, give us this day our daily bread. They came out, they said, where's the bread? Did you pray to God for bread? They said, yeah. Did he give you any bread? They said, no. All right, you want us to give you bread? You pray to us. Give us bread. All right. And they bring in the vans and they start handing out bread. You see, we're God. We're the, there's no God. Whatever God there is, it's communism. So for simple people who are just thinking, well, God is supposed to supply us, we ask him, why didn't he give it? Then they lose their faith that there's some type of a higher reality. It's not a very scientific method, but I've seen that these are the type of methods also that have been used widely in the third world countries to convert different people to one or another way of thinking. So that is the normal level of a pious person, God-fearing or God-loving person. What Krishna consciousness is dealing with is a totally different level. It's not dealing with the normal level known as religion, which means certain sets of rituals to perform pious activities to get one's material prosperity. This is a postgraduate course, a postgraduate practice to actually realize who we are, realize who is the Supreme Lord, and ultimately we can also, as this is a byproduct, realize everything as to the relative situation of the material world that we're living in today. So, because Krishna consciousness is dealing with absolute factors, just like the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, it describes that just as a person goes from childhood to youth to old age, Komaram jovanam jara dehantara praptim dirastatya namuyati. Just as we change so many bodies within this lifetime, right? There's a small child, becomes a youth, becomes an old man. You might have seen our changing body exhibit at our Rath Yatra festival. At that time, at each stage, the body is different. Modern science says in every 7 years, the body goes through a complete change of cells. So that means that we've already changed cells so many times. That means we've changed bodies. So then how is the individual the same? What is keeping the link? You see, modern science may say it's the genes, the DNA, or something else. But the actual continuity is kept because the self, the soul, the person is there within the body. He doesn't change. The body changes. He doesn't change. But when Krishna spoke this, Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, our founder, Guru, made the point that komaram jovanam jara, going from youth to childhood to youth to old age, that statement is applicable for everyone. Whether a person is a Christian, or a Jew, or a Muslim, or a Hindu, or an atheist, or agnostic, or whatever, a communist, a capitalist, it's for everyone. Dogs, cats, everyone is changing the body, childhood to youth to old age. What Krishna was speaking 5,000 years ago, there was no Christianity, there was no Islam, there was atheism. That's a permanent factor. There are always some atheists. And there was Vedic culture. But Krishna was speaking for absolute, for everyone. It's not just meant for a particular country or a particular person. That's why Lord Chaitanya said that the people who are born in India, because they're very blessed, because there these teachings have been revealed they should realize them and then spread them all over the world. Bharat bhumi te manushya jan mohilo jar janma sartaka kori kori poro upokar. The Prabhupada, he took that responsibility and spread this message around the world. That's why the Indian people appreciate Srila Prabhupada as a kind of a transcendental ambassador. Just when his festival was performed in Vrindavan just a month or two ago, November 6th, was his disappearance, his Tirubhav Titi. At that time, the Union Minister of the Central Government of India came down for that function, to pay his homages to Srila Prabhupada. Although Krishna appeared in India, but actually at the time when he was speaking, at that time there was only one world government. There was only one world culture. He was speaking in absolute sense for everyone. A Christian can't say, well, I don't, this doesn't apply to me. In other words, he was speaking on a different platform, not on the platform of religious rituals or that. Different forms of yoga are there, different form of religious ritual are there. They all fit within certain categories. Even the present day religious rituals that people are performing, they're fitting within the category of performing religious ceremonies to get pious result, to have material prosperity. That's one level. The specific ritual might differ according to a certain heritage or tradition. That's one of the levels. Next level are those people who they don't want material prosperity, they want to follow just to increase their knowledge and purity and in that sense, have elevation. Then there are those who actually want to be liberated from the material situation. They want salvation. And then there are those who are directly a devotee of the Lord. They're already liberated. They're already beyond the laws of material nature. This is easy to understand. You take it that the material nature is like an incredible web, like a spider web. It's so intricate that any fly gets into it, he gets stuck. Can't get out. Right. So you take it that the weaver of this material nature, the ultimate creator, the ultimate intelligence behind it, he's a spider. That's Krishna. So if you're a fly, if you're a competitor, then you get tangled up in that material nature and you have to follow its particular laws. But if you're a baby spider, then you can crawl around on it and you don't get entangled. So a person who becomes a devotee of Krishna, someone who becomes connected with him in a intimate, transcendental way, becomes transcendental to the material laws of reaction, the material laws of karma. So when you're already transcendental to those laws, that means you're already considered liberated. So the concept, one person is the fly, he's like the fly stuck, he wants to get out of that entanglement. The devotee, due to the relationship with Krishna, is already transcendental. Jai Sri Sri Radha Radha Kanta. So, I thank you all very much for coming here, and we'd like to invite all of you to come every Sunday and take the spiritual food. So this is very easy. You don't have to change that particular direction. Look for the happiness for a little while in eating the Krishna food, chanting Hare Krishna, serving Krishna, and if you feel transcendentally happy and satisfied by that, then you can go on and then go into it further. You can go from either direction. You can go first directly into the meditation, and if you feel any change, then you can inquire, what's it all about? Or if you're the kind of person doesn't want to do anything until you figured it all out, Then you can read our books and study and try to figure it out first, and then if you're convinced that there's something behind it, then you can chant. Both for those who are the more inquisitive seekers of the truth, as well as those who are the committed seekers of happiness, there's the avenue for both. And for those who want both, truth and happiness, then you can chant and read simultaneously. Well, if there's nobody else, then you get... Anyone else?
I don't know if it's possible. I'm trying to rectify, if possible, the contradiction in this concerning the position of Christ. One spirit you ask the claims of the incarnation of the person of God is, another claims of the appeal to hold the spiritual master of God. It can't be both.
There are five different types of principal categories of incarnations or avatars. There's the Yuga avatar, Guna avatar, Lila avatar. Then there's the Shaktavesh avatar. The Shaktavesh avatar means the other avatars are directly the Lord Himself coming down into the world out of His own power. There are two kinds of individuals, two kinds of souls. There's the Supreme Self, who is independent, who is unlimited, and there's a limited individual soul. But we all fit in that category. Within the limited individual selves, there are two divisions. Those who are liberated from material conditions and those who are conditioned. So a pure devotee is someone who either was conditioned and became liberated, or who appeared here already liberated. As a pure devotee, that person already would have the power of Krishna behind him, with him, but normally they wouldn't be called a Shaktavish avatar or an empowered Shakti means power. Shaktavish, avesh means empowered, an empowered incarnation. That Krishna, He may empower an individual soul with His own power. So although the individual's normal capacity would be, say, 100 watts, this is just for example, excuse me, but then Krishna gives him 500 watts, or 1,000 or 10,000 power from His own. It is that He empowers. Although it's an individual soul, for a specific purpose, for a specific task, didn't require that Krishna or one of His direct incarnations come. He could empower one individual with enough power to do that. So because Jesus was able to create a religious system which has lasted for thousands of years, because He, from the symptoms that He had, anyone who has this extraordinary power, if it's a spiritual power, it's known as normally a Shaktavish, and if it's a material power, it's known as a Vibhuti. Even say someone like, you could say that the power that Muhammad Ali had to win 3 world boxing champions, it was a Vibhuti. It's not spiritual. But it was some special strength that he had. It was a Vibhuti. Anything strong in the world, you could take it. Well, it's a portion of the total power that is resting within Krishna as a Vibhuti, or within the total material energy of Krishna. So Christ would fit in the category as a Shaktavish avatar, as being an empowered. So in that sense, if someone said he was an avatar, there wouldn't be a contradiction, because at one occasion Srila Prabhupada described him as a Shaktavesh avatar, which means not God himself, but as an individual who is empowered by God, which he said he was the son of God, or that he is an individual, but he had definitely some extraordinary powers. As regarding to being a pure devotee or a great devotee, well, to be empowered like that, you'd have to be a great devotee. He wasn't preaching specifically pure devotion exclusively. So in that sense, he may have been empowered for a certain time and for a certain system. But from his teachings, he wasn't preaching for all time and all system. And for all, it wasn't... I don't want to bring in the controversies of that. We're aware from many scholars that there are other literatures attributed to Jesus which are much more in keeping with the Vedic tradition that he was supposed to have been brought up in the 16 years when he was out of public eye. They have his footprints in Bombay. These other literatures claim that he did go and spend time in India, and then he went back, and then he began his gospel preaching in the Far East. But that's a whole, we don't like to really discuss too far off of our own understanding of Krishna consciousness, of the Vedas, because then it can just get to be a big controversial thing, because everyone has their own opinions about Christianity, and that's really not what we're here to discuss about. But since you wanted to know whether Jesus could be an avatar or not, at the same time be a great devotee or not, so I wanted to address that point, that there is one type of avatar known as a Shaktavesh, which is a great devotee, or an individual soul, a great sage, or someone who is empowered for a particular purpose with a particular potency energy of the Supreme Lord, and he can perform that particular task. So he could fit within that category. But if I want to go further than that, then we will... Huh? You want a definitive answer? So I told you, the way I should, huh? I just showed you how it could be both.
In one way he was saying that he was Krishna himself, an incarnation of Krishna.
No, in incarnation, there's five types of incarnation. One of them means that you're empowered by Krishna. So that's also considered incarnation. No, that's considered to be an avatar. The name is avatar. Avatar means in Sanskrit incarnation. So in a general sense, someone could say he was an incarnation, but in a specific sense, no, he wasn't Krishna. And I'm sure that the spiritual master, if you would ask him, he would explain that in that sense, that it was Shaktavesh.
Well, what is that? His actual name really is Krishna.
Huh?
Christ calls Krishna, which means Krishna.
No, but the etymology of that is that originally it was in Hebrew or Greek, Jesus of the Christ. Jesus of the Christus. Jesus of Krishna. Jesus of Krishna. And just for short now they say Jesus Christ. Or it used to be Jesus of Christ. In the ancient etymology, the language. I can't hear what he's saying.
There was concern that the people would see his life. He emanated such a light that people would recognize this and soon would fall down to his feet to worship. And he would say, do not do this. He said, worship God in spirit.
At that point, Srila Prabhupada said that, you know, the pure devotees, if they want to, they have mystic powers. The Bhakti Yogi gets the eight forms of mystic power at a point in the development if he wants it. But to show those mystic power, then the people will be all attracted by the mystic power. They'll worship to get the mystic powers. But then you've defeated your purpose. You want to direct them to develop some their relationship with God, with Krishna, to develop their love for the Supreme Lord. But instead, they're developing a desire that I'd like to get that power myself. I'd like to be able to light up the dark street in the middle of the night, or to have that type of power. I mean, the people worship power rather than worshiping the powerful, where it's coming from. So that's why the pure devotees, even they could show these type of mystic powers, they avoid it. Because in doing so, in showing these type of powers, people get distracted from achieving the more what's for them is much more beneficial spiritual rewards. So in a sense, it's considered that these people, in other words, Jesus tried to preach to them by words. He had such a hard time, or they were, you know, so slow in understanding that just by sheer mystic exhibition, he had to bring them under his control. That meant his audience was a little bit less intellectual. Otherwise, like Srila Prabhupada, he didn't have to show any mystic power, and he could convince the people in America and Japan and different countries. But that's considered a much more high level of preaching. There are preachers in India that they show ashes coming from their hand and different things, and you get a certain kind of follower by that. But if it's just dependent upon them showing some tricks, it's not a very high level of faith. It's very much just dependent upon reinforcing by visible things. So that's generally frowned upon or considered to be much lower level kind of preaching, because the people, it'll be very hard for them to get off of that. They'll be fixed that this is the actual goal. Is if you have these powers, that means you've made it. But those powers, according to the Vedic understanding, are just one level. Those powers are also material. The material scientists they want to achieve those same powers themselves. Weightlessness, go anywhere, anytime, by jet or rocket or by flying saucer or whatever, to control the material nature. I mean, that's what everybody, in the whole material world, people are sitting in laboratories day and night trying to do that. So to be infatuated by those powers is actually another subtle entanglement in material nature. To control material nature, you have to be here to do it. That means you can't actually get out of the material entanglement. A liberated person can control material nature, but they don't need to. They rely on the higher intelligence of Krishna, that what Krishna wants is going to be perfect. Because once you start trying to control it, that little bit of miscalculation, and you get entangled. Just like you give people food, and then one batch of food was a little bit off, and somebody gets sick, then you're in trouble. It's like a reaction. You do something like the material scientists, they wanted to bring in, fox into Australia to eat all the rabbits who are destroying their lettuce crop or something. But then they didn't figure out there was nothing to eat to foxes. And then they got a fox problem. And either they're going to have to bring in tigers or... then if they have a tiger problem, they'll be in real trouble. So there's not any real solution to their, you know, their solutions are worse problems. So in controlling the material nature, it's a really only thing it serves at is for the yogi a kind of a confirmation that, well, I reached that stage. I can control. But if he actually gets too distracted by controlling material nature, he'll fall down. whatever bit that they, when they do something exhibition, they're taking away some of their own potency. Then again, they have to build it up. But if you're using your energy in the service of Krishna, he replenishes. So then you just keep building up. It's an actual perpetual motion cycle. As you're giving back to Krishna, he's giving back to you, and it goes on increasing that way. So when you link up in doing a service for Krishna, it just keeps cycling back to you, but in increased form. So then your power actually goes on accelerating. Then if someone wants to cash it in, at one point gets mystic power, then wants to use it, at that time it's not going back to Krishna, it's going for his own ego enjoyment. Then he starts draining out on his power. If he does something that harms other people for any reason, then he's in a big trouble. But in some cases, even great Krishna conscious preachers like Narada Muni, they have to exhibit some mystic power just to... If you're dealing with a rowdy audience, and they just don't want to listen, and you're telling them all kind of good instructions, and they just don't have a brain to hear, then at one point they show some supernatural thing. And I can't do that. He can do it. Well, he must be good. But then it's like the last straw. When you have to do that, it means that. So, I'll let you take your prasadam now. If there are any questions, and you can see me, I'll be for a little bit, for say up till 8. Thank you very much. Well, an angel known as Narada Muni, one of his devotees from the spiritual world, and then to initiate him in how to actually become, how to reach him, how to reach God, how to see God, how to assist him. So he gave him some mantras, a prayer. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Person, who is the possessor of all transcendent, of all qualities in the maximum proportion, in the total qualities rather. So he started to worship, chanting this mantra, meditating, and after 5 months he was able to actually have a transcendental vision of the Lord. For a short time. At that time the Lord said that in your heart I know that you want to be a king. You were seeking me because you're angry because your father rejected you. And you wanted to show him that he can't reject you. It was your ego as a prince. You were wanting to find me. So I'm blessing you. You can become a king over this area for this period of time. And he said, but now that I've had a vision of you, I don't want to be a king. What would be a king after I've wanted broken glass and I've got diamonds? Now I want to remain somehow in your association. I want to remain in your service. And so he said, no, you do this as a service. The blessing of spiritual advancement, that desire itself, the person laments, and why did I desire that thing? Now I'm stuck with this material situation. So actually, when the devotees are praying Hare Krishna, they're offering it, that's a prayer. But what they're doing is that, say you want to make an offering to God, so that some people might offer gold, some people might offer service, some people might offer so many different things. Well, the vibration of God's name on the absolute platform is not different from God. A material name, like in English this is book, in Spanish this is libro, in Bengali it's called boy, in Hindi it's called kitab, there's so many words. So the material vibration, that's a word that signifies some object, is different from the object. If I'm thirsty and I yell, water, 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 unless somebody compassionate comes up to me and hands me a glass of water, it's not going to quench my thirst. Because the name and the vibration and the name and the object are different. But in the absolute platform, because there's the oneness, when you get to the platform of God, the platform of absolute, there's no differentiation. There's no differentiation in terms of the spiritual essential quality. So the name, which only indicates the Supreme Being, is not different from the Supreme Being himself. There's not any difference in potential potency. So what could be a greater offering than offering the Lord himself? When you're chanting the name, just like the Lord's Prayer says, O Lord, our Father, hallowed be thy name. If you read the Psalms in the Old Testament, there's verse after verse glorifying the name of God. Throughout the Bible, there's verses glorifying the name. The rabbis used to chant the name of God, but they wouldn't allow the ordinary, what do you call them? The people, the congregation, the laymen. They wouldn't allow them to chant these names. It wasn't spoken out loud to the layman. It was a guarded secret, because they said that the name of God was so holy that if you were to say it, that you would possibly be damned. Don't say the name in vain. So the word God is a title. It means the controller, the creator. It's not a, it's not like prime minister or president. It's not his personal name, or it's not a very, it's just, of course, in one sense, God doesn't have a name. In another sense, he has unlimited names. You can't limit God to one name. You can't limit him to one concept. But there are some names, like the word Krishna is a Sanskrit name. With, if you go into the definition of it, there is no one else who fits that definition except for God. So there are some words, like if you say the Supreme Lord who is one without a second, well then, that would definitely indicate one individual. But if you would say the controller, well, there's a lot of controller. The controller of New Orleans is Morial. The mayor, controller of the state is somebody else, controller of USA, you can find so many controller of the universe, there may be someone in charge of this universe. But then when you say, if you say the supreme controller, and then, you know, then there's also the definition supreme, how many, you say supreme controller of what? Of the universe, so that the supreme absolute controller, of which there's no one over him. Then you're going to, in this way, so the Christians, they have I'm certainly believe that when they pray God, they indicating their supreme controller, the one, but there's nobody above him, the ultimate. But there are a lot of subordinates, which they might not be aware of. So the actual thing is that if a person's a real, wants to follow Christ, where is there the contradiction in chanting the names of God? And it just happens that Krishna is in Sanskrit. If you want to chant the name in Greek or Hebrew, or God is also, my Lord, my God, that's in English. Now we may choose to chant the name in Sanskrit because it's the original language, and it's a language is filled with tremendous potential for glorifying God, as well as for discussing spiritual topics. And it has a broad, like there's a collection of 1,000 names of God. Different names that don't indicate anyone else but God. And by meditating on these different names, that's also a form of prayer. So it's done as an offering, that I'm offering this to you for your pleasure. I don't want anything in return. Or someone might offer it for something in return. There are those also that will chant the name of God so many times, just like someone chanting Hail Mary on the rosary, and then they do that because they want to have their son or daughter get cured from leukemia or something. People may do that. But the higher offering is if you're doing it as an offering, and you leave it, even if you have a desire, you leave it unspoken. No condition. I'm giving this to you unconditionally. You do what you think is best. So actually what the Krishna conscious, for those people who are interested in the religious aspect of it, or the, that actually this is a, like a postgraduate course, even for Christians, how to develop love for God. The system's here. You'll find, if you look, you'll find that we're not presenting something altogether new. We couldn't claim that. It's in the Bible. But people don't practice it. People don't understand it. Because that discipline hadn't been handed down or hadn't been promoted very much for whatever reason. But the essence of it is mentioned there. But Lord Chaitanya, you can get volumes. If you read the Nectar of Devotion, it's a detailed step by step that as you're chanting the name of God, as you're developing, what will be the symptom? When a person begins in spiritual life, he's 99% material conscious and 1% God conscious. He has just only one quality, faith. That's considered to be the lowest level. And if one goes up from faith and starts to associate with actual spiritually awakened people, people who are real devotees, who already are situated in the path of developing love for God, then it's considered, say, if you take it 100% God consciousness is the goal, and 100% material consciousness is the antithesis. So then it's about, say, you could say 12%, or 4 bits is a dollar, 2 bits. They had a bit system in ancient India. 16 bits. 4 bits are a dollar? 4 bits is a quarter. 4 bits are that way. Well, they had 4 bits, and then they had a quarter divided into 4 bits of a quarter. So that would be not 2 bits, but a half a bit. Anyway, slightly different system. 16 parts was called an anna, 2 annas. So anyway, 1/12, a 1/8, that means 12 and a half. Then the next stage after that is called a nar. Anyway, I don't know if you want all the stages, but anyway, all those like different stages are given. It's all described. They're very, what are the symptoms? What are the ways it's developed? And on that basis, you can analyze yourself. How are you progressing and developing love for you? So actually, when you understand the science, then you see that, well, if someone says, well, I'm a Christian, I'm attracted to Christianity, and we pray to God, then you don't want to say that, don't do it, it's great, do it, it's wonderful. Why? There's nothing wrong with that. But then at the same time, then you know that, well, what is their concept of, how deeply do they understand that who God is, and what is their relationship, or what are they actually praying for? That actually if they were offering a service selflessly, if they knew that science, then they would get such a reciprocation. If you offer a love to Krishna, to God, you get the reciprocation of His love. That is so incredible that what any material thing you could ask for Him is just garbage, it's just ashes, it's nothing. People are running all over the world looking for a friend just to get a little love. Can you imagine if you're exchanging love with God? That's where it's at. That's not a question of commandment, but that's what you think that Jesus Christ was running on. He wasn't running, he was running because he had some experience of real love with the Supreme Lord, or to some degree. So that's actually what people are really hankering for. They're looking for a friend, maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend or some sort of friend. They're looking for that. But a human being can only reciprocate so much. So actually what we're not again, like Prabhupada said, that any process, if it can develop love for God, it's a bona fide process. We're not, if it's Christianity or whatever, we're not against that. But the process of Krishna consciousness is just a very systematic system which is based upon principles which are really not limited to, they're not like dogmas limited to one geographic area or one, they're purely spiritual processes then, because all of us are spiritually one. I mean, physically one may be an Indian, one may be white, one may be black, one may be, Arabian body, this, but spiritually the soul is of the same quality, part of God. So the spiritual, when you get up to the spiritual processes, there's not a difference. It's a universal. I mean, even the teaching about in Jesus said that love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. How to do that? It's a universal, what he said, it's a very universal thing. I mean, anyone has a heart, has a mind, has how to do that. So it's not possible just suddenly to redirect all one's affection, all one's energy, all one's attachment and give it to God. Especially if you don't know anything about God. It's very difficult. Unless one would get some incredible blessing, it would normally not be possible to suddenly redirect it. So there's been a system given how to do that in a very gradual way. Through meditation, through prayer, through a complete environment. And that's what, you know, that's what Ladita Priya does. She's chanting Hare Krishna. Gradually she's purifying her consciousness. She's developing in that. That's a prayer. But it's a selfless prayer. Or it can be a selfless prayer. And that's considered to be the greatest offering you can give. Because you're offering something that if God has to pay you back, say a person donates $10 to God. So say if he decides to give you 100 times multiple of 100 because you gave to him. So then you get 10 times 100 is 1,000. But if you give God something which is unlimited, you give him his own name. I'm offering this to you. Hare Krishna. How is he going to repay that? So what happens is like, by giving your energy, you're giving your mind to the Lord by concentrating, by meditating, by offering to him his own name. You directly bring yourself into his association. Then he gives himself to you. He gives his love, his reciprocation. He reveals his mysteries to you. Depending on how much you're really concentrating on, how much you want it.
This is when I offer, when I pray every morning, I offer myself in that. I have a Christian friend who do the same thing. I believe that even the simplest person, even though he doesn't, he's not a real intelligent, if he asks, for what he wants you to do, he will give you the knowledge, or whatever, for whatever task you have. This is what I was.
The Chaitanya Charitamrita describes that we're wandering about in the material world. Amanda Bhagavati Kuno Bhagyavanji Guru Krishna Prasadi Pai Bhakti Lota Beach. And we get the mercy of Krishna and the spiritual master. By the mercy of Krishna, by the mercy of the... do you have a question?
Yeah. I'm late for it.
All right, but if you had a question, then I'll stop and ask your question.
Okay.
That by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, one gets the mercy of... by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, he leads one to a spiritual master who is already in touch with the Supreme Lord. And that spiritual master knows how to engage that individual in the service of God, of the Supreme Lord. so that that person can return back to the Supreme Lord. Because in the initial stage, if you leave it, the danger is that the Lord may, from within, give some instruction, but our receiver is not so pure, we can get it messed up. We can get a lot of static from our mind. And we can a lot of times just concoct something mentally, and we may think, well, it's a religious experience. It's the voice of God. It might just be our own mental speculation. It might not really be what he wants. It may be dictated or affected by our own lust or our own greed or our own desire. That's a problem. So that's why we need a spiritual master, and the Lord helps us to lead us to the spiritual master. Then if we follow his instruction, we may get some idea that God wants me to do this, Krishna wants me to do this, and we go to the spiritual master and he'll confirm that, yes, this is an inspired idea, or no, it's an idea which is not going to be beneficial for you. And in this way, through the help of the spiritual master, then one is able to achieve complete perfection. So your coming here may also be definitely part of Krishna's desire. It's up to you to take every opportunity, every situation, try to use it to the best of your ability to help you advance in your spiritual life. Did you get the prasad downstairs? You got the meal? Are they saving for it? Maybe you should see before this. Is there anything left?
There's some power on the juice box.
Better get him something before it's all gone.
You're
from New Mexico, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were here before? Yeah. Bill? Or Bob? Dave? What's your name?
John.
You're Dave.
Sure. Yeah, so I was going to ask you, how does a person increase their preaching better increase my ability to preach if I am in New Mexico?
What's your report from New Mexico? John?
I'm good service for you. I'm using the radio.
You have a short wave?
No,
AM.
Yeah. You know, I was here last time. We were talking a lot about George Harris and his work from
how many times do you chant every day? You count? Well, one way of achieving purity is you should chant a fixed number of times Hare Krishna every day as a minimum. If you fix the minimum, now you probably know that we chant 16 rounds. General devotees as a minimum, but you might fix it at 4, 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, whatever. And that more or less make like an oath or a promise, or at least a determination to not go below that. And if you happen one day to fall behind, you make it up the next day. Or stay up late and finish it. But without fail, you try to keep that minimum. And that's better than one day chanting 100 times and the next day chanting once or none. It's better to every day be chanting 10 times minimum. And you're guaranteed, it's like, what do they call that when you put money in amortization? Keeps on increasing, amortized. Like interest was on building up, creates a momentum. That's how you chanting on the one side and reading. By chanting you'll be able to understand more in reading, and then the other side is avoid activities which are materially polluting. Beyond that, then it's recommended one should associate with devotees. Since you're in New Mexico, you could probably get some tapes, hear lectures of Prabhupada or myself. Since you're in New Mexico, it has a warm climate, you could grow tulsi. The tulsi plant. Water tulsi every day, chant Hare Krishna before the tulsi, offer incense. That's very purifying. Then if you're a vegetarian?
Pretty much so.
If you decide to become Krishnatarian, then you could offer your food to Krishna. That will make you pure. The more that you are spiritually purified, the more that you will be empowered to preach. It becomes like so you just start. Say even now you try to do 4 hours, and it takes a half hour a day. If someday you might be doing 10 or 12, either by count on your fingers, or count with beads, or count with a clicker counter. You fix the minimum, and then do that when it's comfortable, when you know you can do it, then you raise it up. Do the next, do a little bit more. When you get to 16, you don't have to raise it any further. It's enough. Like that, try to get, then you get like a rhythm. You get a spiritual rhythm, which will help you build up more and more strength. Think you can do that? She had her hand up first, didn't you?
As a servant, since Krishna gave you a desire, and sometimes according to your desire, you suffer the consequences of that desire. What is the best way to control the desires? If you want, when you ultimately want to be selfless, to have that pure love, or you don't want any reciprocation, you just want to please the servant. But still, the desires, like, how do you check them before they come up,
First thing is, don't mix up thoughts with desires. That your mind is just like a big national library. It's recorded all your activities in this life and previous lives in a subtle form. And so then a thought may come up. If you desire that, if you want that, say a thought comes up to eat something, then if you accept that, yes, then it becomes a desire. But just the thought itself comes up, it's a potential desire. It's a desire in a very seed form. But then if you either change it, say a desire comes up to eat something, then you can dovetail that. That means then you decide that, well, that would be nice to offer to Krishna, for him to eat. Maybe there'll be some prasad left. You want desire, the thought comes to go somewhere, then it'd be nice to go somewhere to preach or something like that. You can dovetail the thought, or you can just reject it as being not Krishna conscious. But if you latch onto it, if you identify with it, it becomes a desire. So as these different thoughts come up, like a tennis player hitting the ball, you have to knock it in the right place to sort it out. Either by ignoring it, but this has nothing to do with Krishna consciousness, or by dovetailing it, seeing how that idea could be used as a service for Krishna, or by, if it's a strong thought, by philosophically preaching to yourself and rejecting. And whichever one's got a favorable response, they're going to keep coming back. After a thought comes up a few times and you repeatedly reject it, And then it starts coming back fewer and fewer times until finally it doesn't come hardly at all. Just like, say, a person smoking every day. Right? The thought's going to be coming up 1,000 times in a day, 100 times in a day. Then, when gradually, even it might come up more initially when you want to fight it, because then you say no, then your remembering is coming up more and more and more. But after a while, by just gradually reducing and toning it down, and by fighting with the thought when it comes up, or learning how to just avoid it or dovetail it, gradually after a certain point, the mind starts to think about other things. The best thing is to replace the thought with something positive. So that's where chanting Hare Krishna comes in. Some other useless thought comes, we want to reject it. If we just leave the mind blank, it will come right back in again. So then we get trying to concentrate on Krishna or on our service. So this one, some other disturbing thought comes, we can kick it out and then bring back in Krishna. So then gradually that recurrence of thought reduces, to finally the person doesn't even think about it. And I'm sure there are many devotees in the Krishna conscious movement who maybe used to smoke cigarettes many packs a day, but they don't think about smoking a cigarette. In 1 year they don't think one time about it. Maybe when they first came they were thinking about it often enough. It's just a question that gradually the different thoughts go away as you purify the consciousness and practice thinking about Krishna. So you had a question? Is that all right?
I asked if I could speak to you for a minute and you walked along and you got into a conversation with another gentleman.
Where is that?
He's my devotee, all right, to bring him Krishna, and I didn't know. He wanted to ask another question.
I don't mind. I don't know what the sanitary department here has to say about it.
Well, wait for you, but we want to ask another question.
During the course of your speaking to the other gentleman, and I was relating this to a fellow Egyptian priest, he went like this three times, and I asked him, what does that mean? He said, and he did that to my, in front of my face, he said, those are the veils of non-being. And when you got into your car, he said, oh, well, how about you? How's it going with you? And I said, what's what I need to talk about? And you said, they're after you. And I asked my fellow Egyptian priest, would you mind identifying that? And he said, why don't you ask him? Is that something, would it be, or is that something you'd rather answer privately? Or, you don't remember?
At that time you said, how did you know?
Excuse me?
That time you told me, how did you know?
How did I know what?
You told me, but how did you know they were after me?
No, I said,
or something.
That's what I need to speak to you about, because you are one of the few who know.
I think this is going over everybody else's heads.
I should ask you another time.
Personal question more.
Private dharmic fluctuations?
Yes.
It's on a different
when we're having a gathering like this, we like to answer questions which will apply for them.
Which will apply to people of accessible paths.
To those present.
Well, thank you. I'm experiencing some etheric turbulence, so thank you.
You had enough for Shana?
Oh, yes.
As a rule, as a class wants to state that when one is meditating upon the deities, that one should meditate on the feet of the deity. body of Disney due to one's advancement. But sometimes it needs to be looking so beautiful that you can't help but notice it, on the way up, looking from head to toe, that's some proper way you should meditate on and feel around it.
You mean you looked up from the lotus feet?
You know, sometimes I'm dressed so beautifully, you can't help it. Looking all the way up, instead of going to head all the way up.
Could you give me a glass of cold water? Krishna provided. Anything in a circle is perfect. So if you look first at the lotus feet of the Lord, and then gradually look up, then after you looking up at the lotus face, you go back down to the feet, and that's all right. But just that it's not considered very humble. Just go right up and look right up to faith. It's considered humble to look at the lotus feet first. So that's the better, less intrusive. But if you do it in the round form, it's mentioned in the first canto of Bhagavatam, whatever's done in the round is perfect.
Round,
it's a circle. You start at the lotus feet, look at the knees, look at the waist, look at the chest, look at the neck, look at the lotus mouth, look at the eyes, and then look again at the lotus feet. Do you have a question?
Me? Is there any possibility that there are negative forces in this karma? Any kind of blackness or any fish feelings?
Do you know the definition of black magic?
Not worship or the
Shiva or some sort. So wherever there's worship of the Supreme Lord, that is all auspicious. There can't be anything.
Yeah, there's possibly the holy name of Krishna in a negative ways, just using the Maha Mantra and concept of controlling the people.
Because Krishna, he doesn't give any benedictions which would be detrimental to his devotees. If a devotee wanted to use that power to misuse that power upon others, that would cause the self-destruction of that person by the laws of nature, laws of karma. So Krishna wouldn't give such a benediction. That's why people who want that type of power worship Lord Shiva, because Shiva doesn't differentiate the intention of the person, good or bad, whether it'll be good for the person in the long run or not, doesn't differentiate, doesn't distinguish that. That's why traditionally they go to Shiva, they go to Durga, because the demigods, they give their devotee, some of the demigod give the devotee without considering whether it's going to be good or bad for that devotee. For Krishna, being all-knowing, he's not going to dislike if a little girl there asks, give me a knife, I want to play with it. The father's not going to give a knife for the baby to play with. You cut up. Give me a little razor, but I want to play with it. Father never do it. So the Supreme Lord, who everyone is actually the eternal child, the part and parcel, is not going to give something as a personal benediction if it's going to cause a destruction. If a person wants to take it in the ordinary course of events, that's a separate thing, but directly as a special gift, as a boon, as a wish fulfilled, directly by the Lord, he's not going to give something which is going to be destructive. That would be counterproductive. That's why the people who are interested in destructive powers don't worship the Supreme Lord, because in most cases. There are very few exceptions to that.
We're wondering, how do you know when you're in direct communication?
Well, that's why... That's why I was explaining that if one has a spiritual master, that's why the system of disciplic succession, that there's Krishna and his disciple, God, disciple, spiritual master, disciple. So through that disciplic succession, there is a connection. So that way, whether one personally has a connection with God or whether one is not exactly sure, but in any case one would confirm according to the scriptures, according to the spiritual master, and according to the great devotees. Because the danger is that one wouldn't want to make a mistake on the assumption that I'm in connection and do something whimsical or independent. So to be secure, to be safe, then one does everything. Even if one feels very strongly about it, even if one maybe feel dead sure that this is inspired, but as a check and balance, if nothing else to show an example for others, one would go to the spiritual master, which confirm it with the scriptures. Because the scriptures are subject to interpretation, therefore the spiritual master is able to tell what the exact interpretation of that particular passage in the scriptures means, whether it applies or not. If a person disuses the scripture, there's also room for misinterpretation. You can kind of stretch out a few different meanings if you look at one particular verse in isolation, but then if you know the total gambit of the spiritual science, and you can see how it all fits in. But if one has actually realized God, realized Krishna, then it's no question. Just like if you ask a person, how do you know when the sun comes up? Say like somebody lives in the North Pole or somewhere, doesn't, you know, happens to sleep 6 months a year and he just misses it every year. Sun shines 6 months and sets 6 months, and he just happens to like go underground for this. And so you ask somebody like, what is this? How am I going to know when the sun comes up? I'm going to stick around and this year I'm going to see the sun. How will I know when it comes up? You know, he has his flashlight, he's got his, you know, he's got his lantern, he's got everything all set up, you know, to wait for the sun. I don't want to miss it. But when the sun comes, no, you don't need, it doesn't need your flashlight, it doesn't need anything. So it's like that, is that when a person actually would realize God, there's no doubt. A lot of people think they realize God. That's a different thing. That's unfortunate, but a lot of people, they take, like, they see a light, or they have some experience, or they have a dream, or they may have some kind of an effective, even hallucination, or some experience, and they may think that that's a God realization. But an actual realization of God would be, the symptom would be that the person would be completely attached to God after that, and would not be affected by the material attachments and things which normally would affect other people from one point of view. And it's not so easy to realize God. It's not that people, you know, walking down the street and then suddenly just pops up or something. It's not something that takes a concerted. Who's
the president?
Tom?
I'm back.
Ram.
He's been standing here.
He's will be helping with the cleanup, him and several or a few of the men.
That is sure, so that's why you're working right here.
That's you?
He's doing some good service. Yeah, that's
him. He's Ram or Ray?
It's either Ram, Ray, or Raman. One of you guys.
Raman. His name is Raman? Yeah, I told him his name is spiritual Raman. Radha Raman. So we don't stress realization of God per se as the prerequisite, because that's very rare. Normally that only happens after people die, after their bodies are finished. But one can in this lifetime realize it's not, it's happening, but it's very rare. But the connection a devotee can feel by chanting, just as you feel a connection when you find yourself in some difficult situation and then you see how things fall together and seem to come about, and you can feel that there's more than meet the eye, that there's some type of help you're being given, or like that. If you ask these to tell you about the things that happen to them when they go out and preach, they have stories which will make your hair stand up. The incredible things that happen. So they feel the presence or connection in that way throughout their day, and by chanting they feel connection. After you chant a number of times, just by chanting you feel a very deep connection. But just because one feels the connection, that doesn't mean that one gets an idea to do something, that one's going to, one would still want to confirm that with the spiritual master. After confirming and after a certain time of maturity, then one's connection would be recognized by the spiritual master to be so in tune that the spiritual master would authorize that person to become a spiritual master, would authorize that person to confirm other people's inspiration. And that's how it's handed down. Originally, Jesus had disciples, and they had disciples, but I don't know what happened. I know that in India, when St. Thomas came, part of India, he had disciples. That system was there, but then what happened afterwards, I don't know.